North-South Connection Podcast Network listeners, welcome back to the year that was, and here we are with our 16th episode of the year that was. So, for those of you just joining us for the first time, my name is Aaron, and 3 years ago, I started watching every single WWE pay-per-view. I watched them all, I ranked every year match by match, and this series has been all about ranking the years from the worst pay-per-view of year of all time, which was the 35th at number 35, which was 1995, and we're going all the way to the best. And here at the 16th episode, we are dealing with what I think is the 20th best year in WWE history for pay-per-view. We're closing in on the median. The median is 18, so we're going to get to that in a couple episodes. But for now, we're just a bit below the middle. And this was not a year that I thought would necessarily end below the middle, because it's got some really interesting advantages, but it's also got some interesting disadvantages. The first thing I'll say about 2014, which is what we're talking about today, is and what I love about, if you haven't already, on Facebook we have a group called The Place to Be. It's kind of an offshoot of Place to Be Nation, but you got a lot of the old Place to Be Nation guys. You have anybody working on the North-South Connection podcast there. And we have a discussion group where I like to put out what we're going to be talking about in the year and if you want to ask anything or comment, and I'll try to get everything on the show. And Justin Pratt really echoed what I thought my sentiments for the year were when he wrote, 2014 may be the last year of true investment for me personally. Punk was still there and Brian was on his way to the moon, so I wanted to see that through. And I couldn't agree more. I think 2014 was probably the last year I was truly invested in the product. And I think as we go on here, we're going to end up seeing, it's going to become clear why. It's a year where, 2014 that is, where they took risks. And they kind of mediated those risks with really awful decisions that would hurt them long term. It's also a super important year for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, it's the first year of the network, which is huge. It's maybe, I mean, it's arguably up there as the biggest thing that's ever happened for this company. Their entire model has changed as a result of having the network. But it's the first year of the network. And it's also the debut of NXT as a force in the promotion. From this point on, I believe every single year after 2014, the match of the year is an NXT wrestling match, which I wouldn't have imagined back in 2014. I would have maybe thought this was a bit of a one-off. But alas, it's still going strong today. The trend of NXT is not slowing down. A couple of through lines I wanted to talk about as we go through the year. And I don't want this year for me to come off too negative on this year, because I quite like a lot of it. I just think that the problem with 2014 is a lot of seeds are planted in it that grow into weeds that we're still dealing with today. And we're going to see it as we go. So a couple through lines. First of all, listening to the fans is finished. That ended at WrestleMania 30. That was the end. And I think you can make an argument, I'd entertain the argument that the main event of SummerSlam 2014 is also listening to the fans. But I don't know. I think that was done for different purposes. Another through line. The focus on Bray Wyatt is really not great for the promotion. A character that came out in 2013 with so much promise has been kind of an albatross in everything he's done. He had this really hot run as The Fiend in the last year or so, but even then, like, there's just so much crap that goes along with him. 2014 also begins the inorganic rise of Roman Reigns, and it's coupled with, I think, probably the wrong guy in the Shield going heel. And finally, there's seeds in this year of what's going to happen in the women's division, but it's not there yet. And we're still in the Divas division era. So what I did for this project is every year I'd watch every pay-per-view. Then I would rank all the matches. So if there was 99 matches in a pay-per-view year, I would rank them 1 to 99 and they get points. And that's how I determine who the wrestler of the year was, what the show of the year was, right? And then I would measure the year on 12 categories. And then we'd have an aggregate number that gives you the score. In this, because I'm ranking things like 1 to 35, a lower score is actually better, because if you finished first, you get 1 point. Now, I could have moved that around, but I didn't. So 2014 has 171 points, which is 14 points ahead of 2012 at 21, which is great. I mean, there really is a delineation between the 20th place and then, say, 21 to 26. They're all kind of in the same vein, right? So it is substantially better, and I think it's a good year. Now, the first category we talk about are matches. So what this represents is the average match score from every match on pay-per-view. And for 2014, I have the average score at 2.931 stars. Of course, they're my star rankings. To give you, I mean, I haven't done this in a while, so my baseline is 2.5 stars. So if you're a If you just have a good squash match, that's 2.5 stars. If you haven't done anything to hurt the show, 2.5 stars. My good matches begin at 3. My great matches begin at 4. And then as you go lower, it's where things start to really hurt. I don't do negative stars, so if you're getting 0, you're fucking terrible. So 2.931 is just a bit below good on the average, which is okay. 13 great matches. And I'd also mention that of all the matches, 56% of the matches were good. Which is good. That's not a bad rank at all to have 13 great matches. In fact, it's quite rare. So, good year for very good matches. Now, the problem is it gets hurt by also having bad matches, and that balances, and which is why the score is what it is. There was 105 total matches on pay-per-view or NXT TakeOver for 2014. I can't believe in 2014 we're still having John Cena and Randy Orton fighting twice on pay-per-view. You'd think that the lesson would be learned earlier in the year when the crowd completely shit on the thought of these two going at it. But, of course not. By October, they're back inside a Hell in a Cell fighting for who's going to be the number one contender. And it's frustrating because it seems so obvious that they're on the verge of moving on from these guys. They've taken the risks they need to move forward, but then they go back to the well with the same old shit. The year is also hurt by the women's division on the main roster. It really does bring down the overall quality because it does get some focus. There's at least one match on every show, and they get a bit of time too. Now, as long as AJ Lee and Paige are fighting each other, it's fine. Yes, Paige is super pale, and AJ was feigning madness, but they tried, right? They really tried. As soon as you put them in there with anybody else, the results are abysmal. Of the 10 worst matches of the year, 5 of them come from the Divas division. And it's kind of sad because Paige started the year really breaking barriers in NXT. And then by the end of the year is needing to carry Tamina to something watchable. Why couldn't they bring Emma up to the main roster and not give her that stupid dancing gimmick? She was just a fucking badass in NXT. She could go in the ring and now she's just doing this stupid pointing dance. I don't know who that character was for. Wasn't for me. It wasn't for anybody. And why are they punishing Emma? Why aren't they punishing Tamina? Emma's father didn't even kill anybody. Why does Vince hate Australians? Emma, Outback Jack, the Kangaroos? What is it about Australians that Vince McMahon hates? Is he just jealous because they're happy? The worst match of the year. For me, I mean, I'm going to talk about two matches here. But I want to mention that what I thought was the worst match of the year was AJ Lee versus Nikki Bella from the Survivor Series. It's a minute long. So it's a hard sell as worst match of the year. And it was a complete copy of Daniel Bryan's 2012 loss at WrestleMania to Sheamus. Now, here's the problem I have with it. Number one, it was clearly a spite move. They didn't like that CM Punk was gone and AJ Lee was marrying him. They didn't like that, okay? Clearly a spiteful move. There's no reason to, like, bury the cornerstone of your division for the past 2 years. But the big problem with it is it's so damn uncreative and doesn't make any sense. You want to squash her? Fine. You want to be spiteful like you always are? These people that like defend everything WWE does, like, I think they forget how spiteful a company this is. How petty and small Vince McMahon could be. Like, Ted Turner starts like, hires Hulk Hogan and Macho Man, who Vince didn't even really want anymore or want to put in the ring. And all of a sudden there's a campaign about how old they are. You know, fans dress up like characters and are on the hard camera side. And they're just really, they're such fans of the product that they get dressed up in characters. But the camera catches them. So they have to move them or they're taken away or they're escorted out. I don't get it. I don't understand this company that has this disdain for their fans, but here we are. And it's a shame that it extends to their talent. Like, did Vince really need to fire Jeff Jarrett on TV during the Monday Night War? Of course he didn't. It wasn't edgy. It was just dumb. Just, there's no point stomping on someone after you've beaten them. But there is if you're WWE, because you're the biggest fucking bully in the world. And it's a shame. Like, why is Brie Bella kissing Paige? It makes no sense. It has no context or anything. And why would AJ Lee fall for it? Was she was integrally involved in the exact same moment 2 years earlier. It's a shit show. It's terrible. But look, if you don't want to accept that as the worst match of the year, let me put up another one. John Cena and Bray Wyatt in a steel cage from Extreme Rules. John Cena in a cage is the usual in-ring product from these two. So not overly exciting, not horrible. Bray Wyatt, someone needs to sit down and teach Bray Wyatt psychology of wrestling. Because Bray Wyatt's the biggest offender for me of guys that momentum changes in a match for no reason. Okay, this is happening. Now I'm doing my stuff. Now I'm doing this. I've never seen a Bray Wyatt match that has a story in the match. I've seen wild brawls that have been pretty good, usually involving the rest of the Wyatts. But with him, there's no storytelling to the match. Unless he's getting fucking smashed in the head with a hammer until he can't work anymore. So it's not the worst in-ring match. It's long. But I'd be remiss if I didn't mention how stupid the finish is, which almost entirely tanks the match. Why can't the young up-and-comer just beat John Cena? Why does he have to have a child at ringside singing for John Cena to lose? Whose child is that? Who allows their child to come into this world and be used like this? How did he get there? Was he under the ring the whole time, pissing in a fucking bucket? It doesn't make any sense. And why is John Cena so bothered by this child? Is John Cena so terrified of fatherhood that the mere sight of a child is enough for him to lose all his focus? Now, this is a one-off, right? Okay, they did this thing. But no, okay? It's the first time I can really think of this type of finish. By the end of the year, we're getting holograms in the ring, so it's somewhat influential. Within 3 years, we're getting Bray Wyatt and a match full of maggots. The influence of the Bray Wyatt bullshit starts here, and it starts with kind of an innocuous cage match, which is like really the only time, besides the Firefly Funhouse, that Bray Wyatt was allowed to beat John Cena. Let's talk about the good though, okay? Because there's a lot of good in 2014. Top five matches. Let me give you some honorable mentions. The Elimination Chamber match for Elimination Chamber is excellent. Bryan versus Bray Wyatt from the Royal Rumble, tremendous. Bray Wyatt's best singles match of all time. And like, no surprises in there, Bryan. Look, Sheamus and Cesaro on Night of Champions and Payback have a great back and forth series for the U.S. title. Usos versus Harper and Rowan as the Wyatts from Money in the Bank and Battleground. Same thing. Man, these teams could just go. And while I don't think they were very big with storylines, at least at least like Sheamus and Cesaro and Usos and Wyatts are giving us hard-hitting, fun matches. And I'd be remiss, too, if I didn't mention Intercontinental Champion Luke Harper, remember that, defending against Dolph Ziggler at TLC in a ladder match. I thought that was a very fun match. I think it might be Ziggler's last great match. I'd have to look at it a bit more closely, but that makes a lot of sense to me. Unless you, I mean, maybe you count some of the Miz stuff in 2016, but whatever. Number five, best match of the year. From NXT Arrival, Cesaro versus Sami Zayn. I have this match at 4.5. And I think that without this match, it's very possible that NXT as we know it today doesn't exist. It gave the NXT Big Show the cred they needed to get extra eyes on it. And it appealed to exactly the type of fan I was at the time. I wanted hard-hitting action, I wanted simple stories, and I wanted the matches to be great. And this is a tough, simple respect match. And it felt special. It felt like watching it, we were on the ground floor of something spectacular. Even though, when you look at the rest of the NXT show, not everything was quite developed yet. But we're getting there. Number four, best match of the year. From the Elimination Chamber, the Wyatt family versus the Shield. Again, I have it at 4.5. Just a war. Easily the best match that Bray Wyatt's ever been part of. The Shield's on fire. The Wyatts are at their peak. And it was like a perfect storm. And it really says a lot about the year that this finishes fourth. Because it's everything that WWE doesn't usually do with six-man matches. It's nonstop action. It's violent. It's hard-hitting. Both teams are presented as badasses. You know, both teams are, no, the Shield's a heel, our faces, but the Wyatts are heels here, and they're not presented as cowards, which is good. Look, if you're going to rewatch a match from this year, this might be the one to do it because it's just such an easy watch. Number three, the number three breast match of the year, Nikki Bella. No, the number three best match of the year. Speaking of Nikki Bella, John Cena defending the WWE Championship against Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam. Again, I have this at 4.5, which is insane because it's a squash, right? But remember, I mentioned earlier there are risks. This is a gigantic one because Brock comes in and murders Cena, right? He must have given him a billion suplexes and then he just pinned him dead. And I love that he hit the F5 immediately. Like just up, bang, immediate down. And you're like, what the fuck is happening, right? What I love about this match, and this is a formula they try to create a lot, but this match was a pure catharsis match for, I think, a lot of long-term fans. Myself was one of them. As someone who had grown tired of the Cena character always defying the odds and always winning, to see him beaten from pillar to post really kind of made up for being ignored by the bookers for the past 10 years. For 10 years, Cena was the never-give-up babyface, defy every odd. He beat Lesnar the first time he fought him, right? And for 10 years... We've told him as fans that he's not who we wanted as top face. And so what happens here is he goes up and he gets destroyed. And with every destruction, you're like, oh, yeah, yeah. We're pumping our fists because it's almost like finally an acknowledgement of it's time to move on. It was so shocking. I invited my buddy Ivan over the next night to watch it. He had to see it. It was that different and special. I'd also like to point out that in this match, Brock's body language is so spectacular. This match, more than any other match, convinced me that Brock really belonged among the all-time greats because he was just such a total package in here. Now, the catharsis match would be replayed a couple more times in 2015 with varying results, but we'll talk about that when we get there. I think the high point of the match, though, is for me when Lesnar clearly says, "That was your chance, John. I'm going to kill you." Which is not something you ever hear in wrestling matches. Number two match of the year from WrestleMania, Triple H versus Daniel Bryan. Holy shit! A Triple H match and a 5-star Triple H match for me. Anyway, I think this is Triple H's best singles non-gimmick match in his resume. And I don't even think it's close. And over the course of this podcast, you've heard me lament how everyone has to work Triple H's style and it never usually works. Well, here they're working his style and it worked perfectly with this match with Bryan. Bryan needed to win this match to go on to the main event and get a shot at the title. Triple H had been calling him a B-plus player for months. I don't know if this is where they wanted to end up, but this is where they ended up. And these guys go out and kill it. Stephanie McMahon is at her absolute best. Imagine me praising Stephanie. She is so good on the outside of the ring cheering Hunter. She looks like such a conniving, like, awful woman. Like, you got this, baby. And, like, it's just so gross, but gross in the best possible way. Like, this is what you wanted to see from him. Again, I don't know if this was the end game when they took the title off Bryan at Survivor Series 2013. If it was, I would consider the whole thing genius. I don't think it was. And I'm going to say something a bit controversial that I've said before, but, you know, never on this podcast. I really believe this is every bit as good as Bret Hart and Owen Hart from WrestleMania 10. But I think the crowd is way more engaged here. And it adds a special element. The stakes are also way higher, right? And the fans were so rabid for Bryan. It was a perfect storm. So I think this stands as the best opening match of WrestleMania history. My opinion. And I love Bret and Owen. I'd have Bret and Owen like right below it in terms of my greatest wrestling matches of all time. But imagine, it's not even the best match of the year. So for my best match of the year, we're going to take over our Evolution in December. Neville defending the NXT Championship against Sami Zayn. 5 stars for me. This is the culmination, for me, of the last great babyface story the company has told up to this point. Sami Zayn just couldn't win the big one. He finally gets a shot at Neville, who's been tearing up NXT all year since winning the championship from Bo Dallas in that ladder match. Imagine Bo Dallas as NXT champion. The biggest sore thumb in that division. Anyway, but back to Sami Zayn and Neville. The action in this match is incredible. It's super smartly worked. It's exciting. It's expertly worked, okay? But that's not what makes it great. It's the emotion. that carries this one. Not only was the crowd begging for Zayn to win, because it was time, but they were so invested, not only in the outcome, but they were invested in the characters and what the characters were doing. Towards the end of the match, Neville's on the ground, and Sami Zayn picks up the title and considers, like, basically smashing Neville to win the title. The crowd begs him not to do it. Begs him. They just don't want him to win like that. The smarkiest of smarky fans watching a wrestling show, in possibly the most cynical of times, vocally beg for the hero just to be the hero and win fairly. That's special, man. And it's rare. It felt like we were watching a real moment. It felt real to us, damn it. But it also, I think it just felt real to Sammy. He was locked in. Imagine having a baby face with this kind of potential and have him on the main roster for 5 years. In the last 2 years, he's been a heel. Now, he's great at it, but they don't have many baby faces. Next category, characters. I have it 26 out of 35. So, I mean, edging towards the bottom half. I think far and away the best character in the promotion this year is Brock, as just a killer of men. A guy who doesn't give a fuck and just wants to hurt people. Whole package just works. I just talked about Sami Zayn. But again, I mean, a white face, maybe baby face, shouldn't work in 2014, but Sami makes it work. I'd also bring up as a successful character, Damian Mizdow. Because it's such a stupid idea as Mizdow being Miz's stunt double. But this guy ran with it, and it was funny. They don't do comedy super well. But when this guy's on the mat, like, selling a headlock, when Miz is getting a headlock in the ring, I don't know. Like, it's, like, on the edge of business exposing, but not really. And, like, I remember him very specifically, like, asking for, I think it was might have been at SummerSlam. It's whenever they're fighting the Usos. Miz gets thrown out of the ring, and Mizdow asks the Usos to move so that he can fly out of the ring, too. It's just such an absurd idea that they rolled with, and I don't know. I liked it. For every Stardust that, like, the character seems like, well, it's a bad idea and it ends up being a bad idea, you get something that seems like a bad idea and actually works, and that's Mizdow here. Could they have done more with him? I don't know. I don't know what the ceiling was, but, you know, this was great. Let's talk about Dolph Ziggler. He's still a show-off, right? That's his character. No more, no less. Zero character development since he came into the promotion. Zero! Sure, he dated Vicky Guerrero for a while, but what's the rest of his character development over the course of his tenure? He's changed music twice. He was perfection, and now he's here to show the world. What is he here to show the world? I don't know. Maybe he's here to show, like, if you don't grow or change, you'd be in the same position in the company for, like, your whole tenure. Guy with all the tools, legit wrestling background, fantastic agility, maybe not the best in-ring storyteller, but that could be taught. Over, crazy over. Why does he not get to the next level? Because it never changes. And I could put that on the writers, but I think it's more on him in this case. Cesaro, man, talk about a guy trending upward, right? Has that awesome battle royal at WrestleMania. You know, you think you're really behind him. And then he's called the King of Swing. And you know what? It's a fine nickname. But just because someone can do the move and you make that their nickname doesn't mean that they have to be, that has to be their entire personality. Steve Austin didn't start calling himself the Stunner and didn't start trying to surprise everyone at every turn. Oh, there I, ooh, boo, boo, I'm here. The Rock didn't behave as though he'd hit rock bottom. He wasn't like a crack-smoking Dennis Reynolds wannabe, you know? They didn't have to do that, right? It's just the name of his move. They didn't dress Cesaro up in a zoot suit. They didn't make him kick and do the Charleston. They got no business calling him this insane name. And honestly, I love Cesaro as much as the next guy. But I think considering how poor he is on the microphone, I think he's done extremely well in WWE. Would I have liked to see him pushed harder? Maybe a great match with Brock Lesnar? Sure. But I don't know. I don't know if he goes higher. Batista playing the most unwanted human on the planet. However, Blue Tista was absolutely inspired. Let's talk about the Evolution guys. Not the Evolution guys, the Shield guys. Evolution guys. Randy Orton's fine, Triple H is shit. But the Shield guys. Look, Dean Ambrose, Lunatic Fringe. A moniker they tried to give Brock Lesnar back in 2003. But does he do anything that would actually be defined as lunacy or fringe? It seems like he wrestles for championships and generally follows the rules of the match. He did wear jeans, though, so I guess that's kind of lunacy. Seth Rollins is an architect. See, these names are so stupid. It's just, oh, we're going to name this guy something. It has no context or reference to them at all, but that's their name. Dean Ambrose, the Lunatic Fringe. Seth Rollins is an architect. Not since Art Vandalay has there been a less effective architect. He's the architect of me turning the sound off when he's cutting promos because his shrill voice just cuts right through my ears into my cerebellum, to the limbic system. If you come home and your wife is having sex with Seth Rollins, if you hear that, John, if you hear that voice moaning, you wouldn't even be mad at your wife. You'd just be disappointed. Like, you could do better. Also, why would you turn on a team that wins almost every time to go off on your own? And now let's talk about Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns. So I never hated Roman Reigns. I think the company did poorly by him. But let's talk about him. This, to me, is the guy who had the most upside in the Shield. He has no character, though. Never has. You can't just be a nickname. Okay, you have to grow and move. And look, now we know he can. As I'm recording this, Roman Reigns is killing it as the head of the table on SmackDown. Amazing. It's an amazing turn from him. Why did it take 8 years to have any character development from the guy? I don't understand why these babyfaces can't have some character development to go with them. And I don't blame him. Okay, maybe I blame him a little. I do think there's things he could do better. But look, I'm gonna put this here because I don't know where else to talk about it, but I think this is actually really important. When they broke apart the Shield, what they did in the immediate aftermath was the first step in ruining Roman Reigns for years. I think 2015 really ruined Roman, but 2014 are the seeds. So the Shield breaks up. Rollins turns on the Shield. Fine. You know, I think it might have been strong with Ambrose turning. Maybe made more sense because he's crazy. He's a lunatic fringe. Maybe he does one thing that's crazy. But that's neither here nor there. The next show is Money in the Bank. And there's two Money in the Bank matches. There's the one for the briefcase, and then there's one for the title because Daniel Bryan had to forfeit the title. So basically, main event guys and mid-card guys. Rollins and Ambrose are put in the Money in the Bank match for the title shot. Again, traditionally mid-card guys who are about to be elevated. Rollins ends up winning it. This is fine. Reigns, however, is immediately put in the ladder match for the WWE title. So when they broke up the Shield, without anything organic, Rollins and Ambrose are mid-carders, Reigns is a main eventer, right? Now, the Shield, I think, was very close to a main event act together. But apart, they were all mid-carders. Instead of an organic build for Reigns, which, I mean, it didn't even have to be that long, just do a few months, he was just made a main eventer by The Office. Now, I know that every main eventer is made by The Office, but they're given a legitimizing run for us to care about it as fans. Like, you get a program where you see them kind of rising through the ranks. Not in this case, and there was no reason to rush. I think this and his promos towards the end of the year where he's just so insufferable. It really hurt his ability to get over as a top star. You're not going to get behind Roman just because, hey, he's a main eventer now. He hasn't beaten anybody to earn a main event spot. He's just a main eventer now. And you know what? It really showed in the reactions. There's a reason why Ambrose, for the longest time, was way more over than Reigns. As a face, Reigns is getting heel reactions. But I think it's because they built him up organically. And Ambrose is not as good as Roman Reigns. I don't think he's as good in ring. And I don't even know if he's as good a talker, right? But he was allowed to get over organically. And he became a main eventer. There's other problems there. So I think it was a big mistake what they did here. If they would have just built him up organically, I think by 2015, you're in a position where people are ready to accept him. Let's talk about the two worst characters of the year. Bray Wyatt. Look, the idea behind the character is really incredible. This backwater cult leader slash rapist. I'm on board, okay? But what the fuck is he talking about? Could there be one promo that makes sense and doesn't make me question that I've forgotten the meanings of basic words? I don't know what a deleter of worlds is, okay? What is that? This world? Why do we want? Can someone stop this man if he's going to destroy this world? And I don't want to ever hear a promo with him. They're all the same. It's like, you and I are one of the same. When you go into the depths of inequity, you best beware the spiders of silence. Because darkness only lights those that see in the dark. run. Now, I'll admit, run is cool if they're frightening. But the character never achieves anything. I have never seen a more impotent character on WWE TV short of Steve Lombardi and Barrio. He never gets new followers. He almost never wins matches. If he does, they're inconsequential matches. Why can't he have success? I think it's just because the company's too scared to be any different. They want every year. Every year they want a Rumble winner that challenges at Mania. Maybe he'll lose, maybe he'll win, but that's the story. That's the same story they tell every single year from January to April, right? Then there's a Money in the Bank winner. And then they tell the exact same Money in the Bank storyline every single year. There's someone who has the Money in the Bank. He's going to cash in when someone's weakened, okay? And then there's also the story of the authority figure that kind of runs through the year. Think about that. Since 2005, and I mean Royal Rumble took longer, since 2005, they have told the exact same story every single year, just with a couple of different people. Now, there's been a couple of little things here and there, but would you tolerate that from any other show? This is what I like about the comics world, right? Because like in the comics, like I like when comics companies take risks. So for example, there was one year where Marvel did a series called House of M, which they kind of based the entire year around Scarlet Witch. Now that's a risk, basing a year around Scarlet Witch, but it gave us a really memorable story. Why can't a year of WWE TV be dedicated, or at least a subplot dedicated, to Bray Wyatt taking over the promotion? Okay? If you're going to do it, do it. Okay? There's no reason why Wyatt can't collect followers for an entire year until finally somebody has to stop him and then everybody's freed. And what are Kane and Miz and Chris Jericho doing that's more important than just being sucked into the Wyatt family? I know Miz needs another Intercontinental Championship run this year, but can't they just be converted to Wyatts? Throw Bo Dallas in there. Instead, we got children and holograms in place of actual character development. I would love a WWE world where Bray Wyatt's standing on the entrance ramp with the whole roster behind him, and you're down to like two or three people that are actually able to stand up to him. I think it could be fascinating. Look, as much as I just shit on Bray Wyatt, I have to mention how great Luke Harper is, right? When you watch any match with Bray Wyatt and Luke Harper on the outside, look how into Bray Wyatt Luke Harper is. Find someone who loves you like Luke Harper loves Bray Wyatt, because it really is special. His eyes, his mannerisms, this guy is tapped in. Awesome performer. I do think the worst character in 2014 is the Authority. The Authority always wins, and it always sucks. How can anyone get any comeuppance when no one can lay a hand on Stephanie? The only person who gets to fight Stephanie is Brie Bella, and then she loses to further a Bella versus Bella feud that nobody wanted. She slaps and emasculates all the men, and they can't do anything but sit there and take it. I mean, at least in 2014, no one was crying like Big Show in 2013. But when you have a character that's so invincible and no one can beat it, you can't actually tell a satisfying story. And no, Stephanie screaming in the ring is not comeuppance. Not in the world of wrestling. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Ryan Gray asked me to do 15 minutes on Adam Rose. Now, look, I'm not sure that's possible considering that's longer than Adam Rose was in the company. But I guess, Ryan, at some point, here we go. At some point, I can stretch it out, but I'm not going to. At some point in 2013, someone told Vince that Russell Brand was a thing, right? Perhaps they saw Get Him to the Greek. I don't know why they didn't design a character of Sergio, who was played by Puff Daddy, as this fucking rage monster who loved Biggest Loser. It's Biggest Loser time. We got to broaden our fucking stream. Instead, we get the WWE version of Aldis Snow, right? Look, if you're wrestling a bunny or with a bunny, you got a ceiling. Especially if you struggle with the bunny and it's a problem. No one ever took Elmer Fudd seriously, and it wasn't because of his dumbass voice. It's because he couldn't handle a goddamn rabbit. At worst, you pop its head off. You grab by the ears, you pull it off. I've done it many times, okay? And you burn the bones down. Now, on top of all this, Adam Rose was not a great wrestler, okay? In a company where everything was gearing towards an in-ring product in which most guys could go. If Cesaro isn't getting a push, what the hell is Adam Rose doing dancing around with a lollipop? He's not going to get any time. I remember going to see Money in the Bank 14 live in Boston. This is cool because actually when I met, it's when I met all the Place to Be Nation guys. So it was kind of a special thing. And that's actually a pretty big event in rekindling my fanhood, you know, getting together with people that like the product, you know. And Adam Rose had a match. What struck me was how poorly the production was for the gimmick. Now, they're usually great at this. So he won a match, right? And he has a theme song where people, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like people are chanting, right? I know it's not the Chicago Blackhawks goal sound, but that's just what I have in my head. But it had this long intro, boom, ba-dum, 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 boom. Like, so he wins the match, okay? But instead of the song starting at the, it started like 1, 2, 3, boom, ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. It was this very low-key win. It really hurt the entire presentation of the character. It should have been 1, 2, 3, ding, 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 pop, ba, da, 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 so that his whole presentation felt like a massive party. And a massive party doesn't have lulls. I'm sorry, Ryan, I can't do anymore. For making me do this, I'm going to make you sit through the plugs now. Mondays at the North-South Connection Podcast Network. Sometimes you get Montreal to Memphis, or you get this show, The Year That Was. Tuesdays, JT, Jenny, and I, TNA Never Dies, doing TNA from the very beginning. That alternates with Jacob Williams' Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast, digging deep into the Ruthless Aggressive era. Thursdays, JT, John D'Amato, and Jennifer Smith, ECW three-way dance, and that alternates with JT and Chad Campbell's Wrestling War Zone, where they're going through the Monday Night War era. Friday is a mishmash of things. You got, sometimes you got Rank and File with Jordan Duncan. Their most recent was about Thanksgiving foods. And then other Fridays, you get The Gang Gets an Always Sunny podcast, where JT, Josh, Richard, and I delve into It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. That alternates with Shrink Wrap, The Psychology of Superheroes, Tim Capel, Jennifer Smith, and Sean Kidd. Saturdays, sometimes Jeff learns wrestlings, but most Saturdays you get No Holds Barred with JT and I. We're doing all kinds of fun stuff, so check it out. And Sundays, we are very lucky to have Mark Claire and Remzo Martinez's Second Print Comics. Check it all out. Ryan, I hate you. Next category, WrestleMania. 4 out of 35. That was ranked on No Holds Barred when we did it. So WrestleMania this year, we had it ranked extremely high. I got a lot of comments about WrestleMania for this one. The general consensus is that this was a very good show for the most part. So, for instance, Kyle Litke says, honestly, lots of really good stuff throughout 2014. Maybe my favorite year of this time period. We get the beginning of TakeOvers and NXT Arrival. And I really love the Bryan stuff prior to the injury, and WrestleMania 30 is one of my favorites. Me too. I think that works. It holds up really well. Cena versus Lesnar at SummerSlam was pretty great and just felt different. Even if it led to the whole the title will only be around occasionally, Lesnar reigns, which I hate! Kyle, let it go. You gotta let the hate go, man. Or feel your hate running through. It was I who allowed Brock Lesnar to run with the WWE title. Oh, I'm afraid that he will not be back to the Royal Rumble when John Cena arrives. But there's also a decent amount of garbage in between. Kyle also really liked the Survivor Series main event, but boy, it's the best Ziggler ever looked, and they didn't follow up with him at all. I know it was meant to be more for Sting, but Ziggler looked like $1 million. But I concur with Kyle that this WrestleMania was very good. Top to bottom, incredible show. I've already talked about how I think the opener is the best of all time. But also, what a beginning with Hogan, Austin, and Rock. I remember watching live, each entrance, you're like, oh, they're topping it. Cool, Hogan's here. Oh my God, it's Austin. Oh my God, it's Rock. I don't know. No one else could have come out, I suppose. Unless they like dug up the bones of like Randy Savage and brought him out. That would have been great. A hologram. They could have done a Randy Savage hologram. Oh, I'm coming for the hologram. Yeah. I love Hogan fucking up Superdome. Such an all-time botch. But the best part of that botch is Austin rolling with it. Coming in after Hogan and saying, damn, it feels good to be in the Superdome. What a tremendous dick move from Stone Cold Steve Austin there. It's just a feel-good moment. And then you get an awesome match. The Shield crushed the Elderly Brigade of Road Dogg, Billy Gunn, and Kane. Cesaro won the best battle royal I think I've ever seen. What a great finish to the battle royal. Cesaro slamming Big Show over the top rope. And I think this match really is helped by very strong performances from Sheamus and Alberto Del Rio. I know it's not cool to like Del Rio now, but his track record is pretty good in the ring. Divas do nothing for 7 minutes. I think we have a big missed opportunity in WrestleMania 30. And I think if this match goes differently, maybe we're thinking best of all time. There's a moment when John Cena's down in the John Cena-Bray Wyatt match, and the whole crowd is singing He's Got the Whole World in His Hands as Bray Wyatt kneels in the ring with his arms wide open. Man, this was the moment to make Bray Wyatt. As much as I don't like him, right? This is the moment to do it, okay? You got to try something new. There's no reason for Cena to go over.
They could have been magic, man. Instead, they went with Cena standing tall. And if there was ever hope of this Bray Wyatt character being a big-time guy, it was kind of lost here. And as they play the safe card with Cena, they take the biggest risk ever by having Brock Lesnar beat the streak. And look, I don't know if it was the right call, okay? But I will trumpet the fact that the presentation of this moment was absolutely perfect. First of all, going into the match, it felt like a foregone conclusion. There's no way Brock's going to beat him. Like, no way. You're thinking they're saving it for a young star, which they probably should have done. But anyway, you're like, no way it's going to happen. But then Brock beat him. Match wasn't great, but he beat him. And they played it perfect. The three count hit. Heyman starts screaming. Everyone is shocked. We're getting all the reactions at ringside. Everyone's waiting. Everyone's waiting to see what happened. And it's long. It's longer than you think if you go back and watch it, right? Everyone, you got the shocked dude in the front row with his mouth wide open. He's famous now. It's stunned silence. Then, in the silence, 21-1 goes up on the screen. And everyone goes, oh! Like, there's a visceral reaction that makes it official. Then Brock's music hits. It's perfect! They made it look like no one was expecting it. It was played perfectly. It's so rare they nail something like this. And I, you know, as much as I didn't like the match, maybe I don't like that this is where it ended. Man, I don't know if I'd trade this moment for anything. And then the night's capped off with another great match where Daniel Bryan beats Batista and Randy Orton, wins the title, stands tall. What's not to love about this show? World title storyline, 24th out of 35. Look, Bryan winning is awful. Shit, he's the worst. No, awful. Why do you say awful? Bryan winning is wonderful. It's great. His chase and the storyline makes no sense. And here's why it doesn't make sense. When you're calling Bryan a B-plus player, it has nothing to do with in-ring competition. The entire reason that the Authority doesn't like Bryan is essentially, it comes down to he's not marketable, right? That's why he's a B-plus player. He's great, but he's not quite there. He's ugly, small, like that. He looks like a goat, all the things they said, right? I think he's a very handsome man. So there is nothing he can do in ring to prove the Authority wrong. He could defeat the whole roster, but it doesn't make him prettier. It doesn't make him more marketable. So in essence, when you set up a feud where you're a B-plus player, you're setting up a feud in which your babyface cannot actually overcome the odds. So even when he wins, it's great, but it's empty. He's still a B-plus player. They can come out the next night and say, you're still a B-plus player. You're still exactly that. Now, if they had said, you're not a good wrestler, then it works into the story. But that's not what they said. And that's not what the feud is based on. And that's why it's hard for me to be like, this was a really winning feud. I was really happy he won. But it's like the writer's trying to be too cute and too inside, right? But in the end, it ends up making the feud nonsensical. I love Brock killing Cena too. It's also very inspired. What I don't like is Bryan, after he wins the title, given the Chris Benoit push of 04, where he fights Kane for the title in the undercard while Triple H main events the show. It's pretty shitty. And Cena as champ when he wins at Money in the Bank is uninspired, only from the perspective that the storytelling is incredibly lazy. Bryan gets hurt, right? And so he has to abeyance the title away, or whatever verb they're going to use. Cena wins it. But instead of writing a new storyline for John Cena, who wins at Money in the Bank, They just slide him into the Daniel Bryan story. So whereas the Authority was working to get the belt off Daniel Bryan, well, now they're working to get it off John Cena because the company now hates John Cena. So it's John Cena against the Authority. Suddenly the company doesn't want to be John Cena champion? The guy that's been on top of the promotion for 10 years? If the entire premise is that Daniel Bryan's a B-plus player, how do you slot John Cena in when he's been the face of the company for 10 years? Then Brock leaves. When he wins, I love him as champ, but the title was missed. Mid-card storyline, 26th out of 20, out of 35, not 26 out of 25, 26 out of 35. Sheamus and Cesaro have a great feud between two hard-hitting guys for the U.S. title. Wade Barrett, he's got some bad news. And Miz are Intercontinental Champions, so is Biggie Langston. They all get matches on pay-per-view, but no one really cares, and they're not given any sort of storyline. Oh, got some bad news. No one gives a fuck about their storylines. By the end of the year, they're sort of building the Intercontinental scene around Ziggler, who is on a hot run after Survivor Series, and Luke Harper. It feels like a step in the right direction, but it's 1 month out of 12. Tag team storyline. 13th out of 35. Man, all about the Usos, Harper, Rowan. They have an incredible series of matches, legitimizes both teams. Yes, it's a problem the New Age Outlaws have a WWE tag team title run in 2014, but Miz and Mizdow get one. Like, the tag team division is kind of like, it's building. They're starting to put some emphasis on it, which is cool. Miz and Mizdow, Goldust and Stardust, Rabaxel for the good and bad. Outlaws, as much as they're outdated. Usos. They're putting focus on it. And if you wanted to lump some NXT tag teams in there too, because I think the NXT tag team title scene is truly great, right? Now. And it's been great for a few years. But it starts here. It really does start here. The Ascension were main eventer kind of guys in NXT. And Lucha Dragons were a fun team for a while. Are they the best ever? No, but they're good. And they allow you to put focus on the tag team title without anything being bad. You get the Vaudevillains coming up too. So I think the tag title scene is optimistic. And that's a good thing. Women's championship storyline. 19th out of 29. AJ and Paige, cool story. Paige shows up in the first night, wins the first title. And then Nikki Bella takes over and the division's not interesting anymore. Which is a shame because in NXT, the women are starting to tear it up, right? You got Charlotte and Bayley fighting. You got Charlotte and Sasha Banks. You got Paige killing it with Emma. It's a really a night and day scenario where it's like, wow, women's wrestling is really good in NXT. Why is it not good on the main roster, right? Royal Rumble match. Now, this was CM Punk's last match in the WWE. Jeffrey Thomas, we see the last of CM Punk at the Rumble, but we hear his name from the crowd quite a bit. That's how much the crowd loved this year. I think this is a... I think this is a... not less than stellar Rumble. That's why I have it 30th out of 33. CM Punk gets concussed and it really hurts the match as a whole because he could have been a great Iron Man, but he can't. Batista gets a hero's return, and by the end of the night, he's the most hated guy in wrestling. I remember at the time thinking, this is the worst. At this point, 2014, I'm like, wow, this is the worst they've ever shit on the fans at the Rumble. And then I traveled to Philadelphia the next year. Who do I think deserve better in this match? I think the fans. And not just for excluding Brian. Although that's probably the biggest part of it. Ziggler comes in, and gets a huge reaction. They toss him out right away. Fandango comes in, everyone's singing, they cut it off, toss him out. He gets tossed by Mini Mantor. By the end, CM Punk's the last acceptable winner in the ring, and he's cheaply pulled out by Kane. And it's really shameful how Vince McMahon can have the balls to tell people to listen to their fans. Honestly, I don't know why no one called an audible here and just had a 31st entrant. After 30, when everyone's shitting on poor Rey Mysterio, right? Poor Rey Mysterio is like in the back considering suicide after. It's bad enough they fucked him, but now 6 years later, they got to take his eye too. But look, he comes out at 30, they start fighting. All of a sudden, the countdown starts again. You put Brian out, you don't even have to have him win, but you put him in the match. And even if he does win, you can contest it and do some sort of chicanery, right? I just don't get it. I don't get what they were going. I guess they were going for Batista and they really thought it would work, but it didn't and the match suffered. Historical importance. When we did it on, when we ranked this on No Holds Barred, we had it 9th out of 35, and I think it's easy to see why. The network, NXT, the streak ending, Daniel Bryan, the Shield guys kind of moving up. SummerSlam, 15th out of 33. The main event's an all-timer. We talked about that. But the worst match is Stephanie McMahon versus Brie Bella, which is terrible. I feel like Stephanie's only doing this match so she can wear that leather outfit. They give way too much time to a match with a non-wrestler and a Bella. And Brie Bella had some heat. They killed it. Bella had proper heat. They were really pushing their way through. And she was over. And they killed it. They just absolutely killed it. And then they had the stupid turn with Nikki and whatever. Then they're acting after. God, I don't know why they don't hire acting catches. But also on the card, Rusev. I really like Rusev and Jack Swagger. Rusev's selling in the match with Swagger's really great. And he carries Swagger through a nifty little power match. And he makes every, like, I think he's got a hurt legs against the ankle lock on. And he's limping the whole way. And he's working with it. And he has to, like, he can't even put the Cobra Clutch on. The Accolade. They can't even put the Accolade on properly because he can't put weight on his foot. It's so good. It almost made me forget that they turned like Rusev from Bulgarian to Russian because Vince saw a picture of Putin riding a horse topless. Jericho and Wyatt have an uninspired match, and Reigns has done no favor by being put in a match with Orton, which they're having again this year at Survivor Series. I would also appreciate if we could stop calling guys Mr. Money in the Bank, because it sounds way too much like Mr. Manager. Lumberjack match was fun. Look, I think this was a good show headlined by the best beating you will ever see. But what was the worst show of the year? Well, before I do that, let me just get a couple of comments here, all right? Because I think, let's go with Dennis Nunez. The beginning of 2014 was a crazy time with all the Daniel Bryan insanity surrounding everything within the company and wrestling community. It was a particularly fun time among the PTBN with a weekly post-Raw late-night discussions about the direction of the booking and whether Bryan would win the title at WrestleMania 30, with some of those debates lasting until 1 in the morning a few times. Bryan finally getting his moment at 30 felt like the beginning of a new era, especially after the show itself, if it was one of the best Mania history. Then Bryan got hurt and was forced to forfeit the title. As a result, the rest of the year felt almost deflated because of what could have been had Bryan been healthy. 2014 also had the best Survivor Series main event of the decade. In my opinion, with Sting returning being the proverbial cherry on top. Sorry for the cliche, you were not excused. Also, the Bella Twins explode feud was a pot of monkey urine, with Nikki Bella's acting in particular reeking of suckiness. Yep. All right, and greetings from Allentown. They set up actual stakes for the Survivor Series and then undid the stipulation about a month later to confirm that nothing matters. Still not as bad as that pay-per-view where Ziggler beat Cesaro in a 2-out-of-3 falls match 2-0. All this after WrestleMania 30 was so good. There's some nice consensus on WrestleMania 30, which I like. So the worst show of the year for me is Survivor Series. I know it got brought up. And I know it's shocking. The show with Seth Rollins on the poster is the worst of the year. How could that be? I think the Tag Team Survivor Series match was fun. The Divas match was garbage. We've already covered the AJ Lynn, Nikki Bella bullshit. Nikki Bella. Hey, Adam Rose teams with the Bunny. Hey, Ryan, we're doing some more Adam Rose. There's that. Bray Wyatt faces Dean Ambrose in a very special nonsense match, which, of course, ends in a DQ and does neither guy favors. But let's talk about the big match. Is it the best Survivor Series match of the decade? I don't think so. And I don't think it's close either. For me, if you think so, that's great. I remember at the time, though, thinking it was really great, right? I remember watching live thinking, wow, this is the best one since 03 where Michaels had that run and Orton beat him. It's got the Sting debut, Ziggler going the distance. It's 44 minutes long. On rewatch, for me, it didn't hold up at all. And it felt like people were just killing time until we got to the big Sting debut. There's so much lying around, so much time killed. And it really also, I mean, this is something I've kind of thought for a long time, but it really shone a spotlight on the idea that, like, they really have trouble laying these matches out now. Henry goes out immediately, gets punched by the Big Show, goes out. Then nothing happens for 20 minutes. Just guys going in and out. Then from minute 20 to minute 30, six guys go out. And then we get a mini match with Rollins and Ziggler. And I think it was a massive disappointment, and I wish it would have held up better. And then, like Greetings from Allentown mentioned, you consider the stipulation of the authority going away overturned a month later. What's the point? Oh, right. Yes. The point was to get Triple H beating Sting at WrestleMania. Best show of the year. When I look at the best show of the year, I kind of have a tie for best show of the year. And WrestleMania is obviously one of them. I think it's one of the greatest WrestleManias of all time that we mentioned. But I'm going to talk about what tied with it, which was TakeOver Our Evolution, which was the December show. To me, this is the arrival of NXT as we know it. Kevin Owens opens the show, breaks his nose to bits, but gets over like a killer versus environmental activist CJ Parker. Imagine a guy named Juice Robinson having a dumber gimmick and being named, and his name is Juice now. There's a fun match in Lucha Dragons, who had recently won the NXT Tag Team titles versus the Ascension, going up against the Vaudevillains. And I think that the Vaudevillains, now everybody likes to shit on Simon Gotch and it's cool, but these are kind of forgotten pioneers in the NXT Tag Division. They were extremely over characters in a division dying for characters. You get the debut of Finn Balor as he fights the Ascension with Hideo Itami. He comes out, he does his interpretive dance on the way to the ring. This, to me, is what the debut of one of the most interesting characters they've maybe ever had, that for whatever reason they didn't want to build the company around. He's great in the ring. He's super dynamic. The Demon is such an interesting catch. Balor would springboard from here and carry the brand for really the next year and a half. So this is an important show for him. Charlotte and Sasha Banks tear down the house. That in a match that puts any main roster women's match to shame. And think about it, they're going to get even better in the next year. I already mentioned the main event full of action and emotion, but it also has the shocking and wonderfully done Kevin Owens turn, which sets up the NXT title picture for the next few shows. I just think this is such a great show. Everything clicked. Yeah, it's not like today where everything cracks 4 stars on an NXT show, but it's such an important show to forge the identity of NXT. Let me get to the rest of the feedback before we do the 5 best wrestlers and 5 worst wrestlers. Jay Hinchy, quite the year is 2014, beginning with the return of Batista winning the Royal Rumble, which I agree should have been Daniel Bryan's to win. But luckily, they righted that wrong after certain someone left. He can't even say his name. Leading to an awesome WrestleMania 30. Also, had a great feud between Evolution and The Shield before Seth Rollins turned to join The Authority. Brock Lesnar ended the streak and then squashes John Cena at SummerSlam. Then we got the awesome debut at Sting at the Survivor Series to oust The Authority, at least for a little bit. Oh, and I forgot to mention the debut of the WWE Network. I don't know. The promotion would have been way better with CM Punk in it throughout 2014. Because then if Bryan goes down like he does, you have someone to pick that up. Or at the very least, someone important on the undercard. But that's just my opinion on Punk. I just thought it was funny you didn't mention it. Victor Parenza, leading up to WrestleMania, was a whirlwind, but ultimately worth the journey. The rest of the year was trash. However, the bright spot was NXT coming into its own. Debuts of Itami, Balor, and Owens were mind-blowing at the time. Yeah, man. Like, you're like, wow. Like, you never thought you'd see these guys in a WWF ring or WWE ring, and here they are. Thank you for everybody who took time to write in the Place to Be group on Facebook. I love interacting in this way, and I love to make these part of the show. I think it's really cool. So please keep bringing it, and I'll try to make sure I touch every one of them. 5 worst wrestlers of the year. Number 5, Ryback. A bullshit chairs match with Kane and an awful run as a team called Rebaxyl. Rebaxyl. Rebaxyl sounds like a back medication, all right? And really what I need is a fucking anti-sleep medication when they're in the ring. But at least they weren't called Team Rebaxyl, all right? Number 4, worst wrestler of the year. Well, it's a big show. Bullshit stairs match with Eric Rowan. What's the point of having a stairs match? They don't have an apron match or a turnbuckle match. And he was murdered by Brock Lesnar. Both Ryback and Big Show are also in that big Survivor Series match, so that's how they make this list. Number 3, Paige. Speaking of murder, Paige had to fight Tamina Snuka in a battle of whose father is more of a scumbag. And look, I don't know anything about Paige's dad, okay? But I'm going to give this one to Super Fly. The only thing I want from Paige's father is his permission for his daughter's hand in marriage. Second worst rest of the year, AJ Lee. She's good, but she's just in too much bullshit. And number 1, worst rest of the year, Nikki Bella. She's terrible. She's awful. I remember writing an article once, kind of tongue-in-cheek. It was a tongue-in-cheek thing of like, everything she touches turned to shit. And I think I made the joke like, you know, someone, what did I say? I said, someone who's so afraid of dying alone shouldn't be wearing anything that says fearless. It was all tongue-in-cheek. People got really mad because I shit on Nikki Bella. But come on. Come on. Compare her to who's coming up. Charlotte, Sasha, Bailey, Becky, and everybody who came after. Even people before. Mickie James is better than Nikki Bella. Beth Phoenix is a million times better. Natalia is better. Boring, but better. Trish is better. Lita's better. 5 best wrestlers of the year. Then we're out of here. Number 5. Sheamus. To you fucking Jesus fucking Christ. Oh! What's going on? Sheamus. And let's do number 4 at the same time. Because really they're for the same reason. Sheamus and Cesaro. Cesaro's 4. They have such great matches against each other. They have these hard-hitting wars. Both guys can go. They're a pleasure to watch. I think Cesaro gets the nod because he's just in 1 or 2 more matches. But both these guys deserve to be on the list. Sheamus, man, this whole period on this rewatch, I can't tell you how excited I always am to see Sheamus. Cesaro's a given. We know he's great. But Sheamus, man, I see him come out. I'm like, oh, good, good. He comes back at the Rumble this year, too, and gets an incredible pop. Like, just incredible. People are really happy to see him. And he fucking destroys everyone in the match. It's really great. Just a hard-hitting guy. I love me some Sheamus. Number 3, Luke Harper. Look, this guy should get most of the credit for all the Wyatt family matches. Not that Rowan is a slouch and Wyatt, whatever. But he's the glue that holds it together. The 6-man at Elimination Chamber and the series of the Usos, they all break 4 stars for me. He has a stellar ladder match with Dolph Ziggler at the end of the year. Look, you put all that together, you get a top 3 finish for the guy with the craziest eyes in the world. Number two, best wrestler of the year, Daniel Bryan. Oof, if he'd only wrestled the entire year. Awesome match with Bray Wyatt, all-timer Triple H at Mania. Great showing at the Elimination Chamber, winning the title in the main event of Mania. Great match. Ugh, it's just a shame he's not there. And for me, the best wrestler of 2014 in WWE, Sami Zayn. Two of the top five matches of the year against Neville and Cesaro. Okay? Incredible in the Fatal 4-Way match with Neville, Tyson Kidd, and Tyler Breeze at TakeOver Fatal 4-Way. Wonderful in the match with Tyler Breeze at TakeOver. Okay? Four matches in the year. It's not a lot, but the worst one clocks in at 3.75 stars. Add to it an all-time character, it's easy to see why he won for me. NXT owes a debt to Sami Zayn. I don't think he gets the credit he deserves. People will turn back and say, oh, it was Finn Balor, Samoa Joe, and maybe the Undisputed Era now, Johnny Gargano. But without this incredible year, the show might not have made enough of a mark for them to keep pumping money into it. And he really is one of the most memorable characters of the era. So 2014 finishes only 7 points out of 18th place, which is the median of the project. Man, 7 points is nothing. Look, this year gets dinged for the Royal Rumble match and the complete laziness when it comes to the WWE title scene, headed by John Cena. To give you some more context, they're 30 points out of a top 10 finish. That's not that far. If you just have a good run... Look, if you have a mediocre Rumble, you gain 15 points because you get put in the middle, right? If they had taken more time with their characters, not flooded the Intercontinental scene with the unmotivated guys, and kept the Divas division to Paige and AJ, even if they fought every month, I think this has a shot at cracking the top 10. NXT is huge, though. Without them, there's a very good chance they might have slipped a few spots. Overall, though, great fun year to watch. Matches weren't bad. I didn't feel as soul-crushing as 2013. It was a hopeful year, but it might be because John Cena finally got the fucking beating he deserved. All right. Thank you to everyone who continues to support the North-South Connection Podcast Network. Leave us a review, subscribe, tell us what you like, tell us what you don't like. Engage with me on Twitter. I'm at Aaron D. George on Twitter. But please, you know, keep it coming. All love is great. Thank you to anyone who has shared this, anyone who has liked anything I've put. It really is touching. And thanks for coming on this journey with me. Next time on The Year That Was, we tackle a year in which new superstars are built and quads are torn. See you then.